Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. This week we're going to be doing a Conan the Barbarian episode, and I'm going to be talking about the literary roots of the character and comparing the two big Conan films, the 1982 John Milius directed film and then the Marcus Nispel 2011 version with Jason Momoa. Got a lot to talk about, but let's get to a little bit of feedback first. I want to just thank for some feedback on my Return of the Jedi podcast. Mike Thorpe, and your very enthusiastic retweet and comments about liking the podcast. Thanks so much, Mike. Really appreciate it. And I want to thank for my Halloween 3 podcast, Matt Hurt and Hedge Knight84 retweeted me. They both favorited the podcast, and Casey Ruggieri also favorited. So thanks to everyone out there favoriting, liking, listening, you know, all of it. Really appreciate it. All right, so let's talk about Conan a little bit. I want to talk about, first of all, the genesis of Conan as a character. It's going to be kind of a pretty inclusive podcast. The very first story that was published that, you know, kind of kicked off Conan's career, as it were, was called The Phoenix on the Sword, and it appeared in Weird Tales back in 1932, believe it or not. The editor of Weird Tales, soon after that story hit, was a big success, prompted Howard to write an essay detailing what Howard was calling the Hyborian Age, which was the fictional setting for the Conan story. So he wrote this huge, this 8,000-word essay detailing everything, which was very prescient on the editor's standpoint, because, you know, Howard would go on to die young, and that essay has been used by a lot of the pastiche writers to set other stories and other Conan stories in the world. He then came out with The Tower of the Elephant, which was a new story, and then, you know, he committed suicide actually in 1936, so 4 years later, Howard was dead, and he had written 21 complete stories. Seven of which had been published, as well as a number of unfinished fragments. Now, Howard had written a bunch of other things as well. He wrote Bran MacMoran stories, Call the Conqueror, tons of stuff. But so only 21 complete Conan stories and a lot of unfinished fragments. So following Howard's death years later, the copyright of the Conan stories passed through several hands. In the 60s, under the guidance of these two writers, L. Sprague du Camp, I'm sure I'm butchering his first name, and Lynn Carter, what they did was they took all of Howard's stories and re-edited them, rewrote some of them, revised some of them, and put out a 12-book Lancer Publishing put out the series, 12-book series, where they set the, you know, they tried to do it like as if the Conan story was done in chronological order. So when Conan was a younger man, we're in the first couple of volumes, and then I think in the later three volumes, he's King of Aquilonia, so on and so forth. But within these volumes of short stories, there were stories written, pure original stories written by Sprague de Camp and Lynn Carter, that Howard, you know, it came from nothing but their own imaginations. They finished some of Howard's fragments as well. And so this was kind of how Conan existed for years. For like 40, 50 years, the original versions of Howard's stories have been out of print. The next big change to the character really started in the 70s when he became a property of Marvel Comics. And Marvel has a long-standing Conan history. Roy Thomas, I think, wrote a lot of them. But they're probably arguably, apart from the books, the vehicle that has the greatest influence on the longevity and the popularity of the character. Marvel Comics and Dark Horse Comics were the two big Conan publishers. So Marvel Comics launched Conan the Barbarian, which went from 1970 to 1993. Savage Sword of Conan, which was 74 to 95. And Dark Horse series launched in 2003. They kind of tried to bring Conan back a little bit and continuing to publish compilations of Marvel stuff and, you know, I think new stuff as well. It's a funny side note. Barack Obama is a collector of Conan the Barbarian comic books, and he's a big fan of the character. And he appeared as a character in a comic book called Barack the Barbarian from Devil's Due. In 2003, finally, what some publishers wanted to do was get Howard's original stories back in print, unedited by DeCamp and Carter. So they went back and they found really early manuscripts. And so there are three volumes. If you're interested in Conan as a literary character and I think the first and best representation of him. There are three volumes. Volume one is called The Coming of Conan the Cimmerian. Volume two is The Bloody Crown of Conan. And then volume three, The Conquering Sword of Conan. And those three have all of the Howard stories unadulterated by later writers. And they also have some fragments of stuff in there that he wrote as well. And one very important element as well, besides the comic books, the cover art for the Lancer series, which then I think became the Ace series, which I know them as the Ace Publishing in the 80s. They were brought out. The same 12 volumes, but just another publisher. The guy by the name of Frank Frazetta did the cover artwork for most of the volumes, if not all of them. And Frazetta's, I remember walking into a bookstore and just pulling out a Conan book and just seeing that artwork. And I was like, I got to read this story. So, you know, Frazetta and the comics, very, very important for also bringing Conan out to the wider world. It was written in 1932. So the character did not only live on in, movies and in books. There's also been some television Conan. So there's been three series. There was Conan the Adventurer, was an animated series, debuted in October 1992. I think it ran for 64 episodes and concluded like a year, 2 years later. There was Conan and the Young Warriors, another animated series, premiered in 94, ran for only 13 episodes. Then the live-action Conan on TV with this guy Rolf Müller, this German bodybuilder, called Conan the Adventurer. It's 1997, premiered and ran for 22 episodes. Very different storyline than Robert E. Howard. You know, Conan's fun and jovial, he's of course, being TV, there's a recurring merry band of adventurers. So, and my own personal thing on Conan is that I discovered the Conan through the Ace 12-part paperback stories. When I read them, I don't think I had seen the Schwarzenegger film until much later. Conan is very, very smart. He's very cunning and he's very worldly. Like, you know, he knows instinctively how to fight, hand to hand and with a sword from his Sumerian roots. But for the years through his adventures, he can speak dozens of languages. He's been trained in almost every style of combat known to man. He's been a general, down to a foot soldier in serving in armies. He's fought all kinds of different bad guys. So he's a very sharp dude, which is definitely different than you see which most of the world knows Conan through the 1982 film, where, he's kind of a lunkhead, really, which is very different, just a different take on the character, one that I did not love coming from the books. Also, just one last little bit, there are probably over 20 or 30 Conan novels written by other writers. After the movie came out in the 80s, I think Tor Books opened up, or they got the rights to publish stuff. Robert Jordan, I think, started it off, who's, readers of Wheel of Time may know. But he wrote the first seven that came out in Tor, and then it kind of broke open the world. And so there's a ton of Conan novels out there for fans of the character, because there's only a certain amount of Howard stories, right? So my personal favorites, Jordan is very good. The Jordan Conan novels are good. There's a couple of ones. He wrote seven of them, and they're not all great, but most of them are very good. There's a guy named John Maddox Roberts, who's excellent, and Conan the Valorous and Conan the Rogue, to me, are two of the best pastiche novels. And there's a guy named Carl Edward Wagner, who wrote The Road of Kings, which is a terrific novel. So if you're interested in Conan literary adventures, I highly recommend you pick up the original Howard stories in these three volumes that exist now, and then check out Jordan and Maddox Roberts Wagner. Just wanted to give you a little bit of a background on the character and where it's been in the media. So let's talk about how the films came into play. The film rights for Conan were kicking around for a while, and the summer of 1977, actually, the world changed with Star Wars. Companies were interested in fantasy as well as science fiction, which is why I think there's a, 80s was like the golden age of fantasy film in a way. So, and at that point, Conan in the 70s, largely popular because of Marvel Comics. So, you know, there was definitely an audience out there for Conan film. The rights were secured by this guy, Edward Pressman. The first big guy to join was Oliver Stone, who wrote the original script, the first script that was ever written, because he was like a name guy at that point. Then they approached Frank Frazetta, the artist who did the covers for the Ace and Lancer series, to be a visual consultant, but they could not bring him to terms. And so Stone wrote this crazy script that was like post-apocalyptic. It was going to be a three-parter. Like, it was bonkers. It was very, very magic-oriented. You know, lots of special effects. And I think it's like Conan Goes to Hell or something. Really crazy story. At the time, it was just way too expensive to film. And so studios wouldn't touch it. At some point, Ron Cobb, who had done the Alien films, was brought on to do some designs for what might be a Conan project. And I think he talked to John Milius, who he had known, about some work he was doing on Conan. And Milius was very interested, having been kind of a fan of Vikings in general. He loved the Kurt Russell Vikings film that came out in the 60s. So he contacted this producer, Pressman, and they came to an agreement. Milius would direct. He really wanted to change Stone's script. He didn't like it at all. So that was they agreed to that. And then there was a bit of business to be done because Milius' next film was promised to Dino De Laurentiis. So they had to bring the whole production to Dino, and Dino basically financed it. Then briefly, you know, Conan comes out in 82, big success. They do a sequel, Conan the Destroyer, not very well received by fans, and did not do much business. And then years and years go by. There's talk in the late 90s of a second Conan coming out called King Conan, Crown of Iron. But Schwarzenegger was about to go into politics for many years, so that died. And then they continued, Warner Brothers continued to try to get the project off the ground, all kinds of development attempts. The Wachowskis took a crack at it. Milius came back and took a crack at it. Robert Rodriguez was the closest. He was going to do something with it, but he left. And then there was a rights issue, so there was some legal stuff that had to happen. So once all the dust settled in 2009, it was revealed that Marcus Nispel was going to direct, and then a guy named Sean Hood was going to write the remake, which was then released in 2011. So, okay, so to the film, I'm going to take this, you know, we're going to compare them as we go along, compare the stories, the characters, and the actors and actresses, and let's see what we got here. So I'm going to start out, both movies start out with these village sequences, I like to call it. So it's basically Conan as a young boy living in a village in Samaria with his people. The villages get destroyed by raiders. So I'm going to start with the 1982 film. The actual 82 film starts with it's beautifully visual that they're casting the sword in this mold, right? So you see this molten hot steel being poured into a mold, and that sword becomes the one that Conan's father works on. One little note here, they made the same mistake with the remake, in that this is not how swords are cast. It looks great on screen. Any sword that was cast like that from steel already melted down and poured like that would shatter pretty much immediately. Swords are taken from lumps of iron ore, and they're beaten down and beat into shape, and they're not cast that way. So, but it looks cool on film. You know, it's a dark screen, and you have the very light, bright molten metal, you know, coursing through the mold and making the sword shape and so on and so forth. But it's a beautiful sword. The swords in both the films are really amazing. But so this sword in the original film is just beautiful when it's done, and it's got this incredible pommel with, you know, carvings on it and this wooden little cross guard. Really beautiful. So then, you know, we have young Conan and his dad. We get this description of Crom and the Riddle of Steel. Really, really terrific actor who plays Conan's father. This guy named William Smith, and he has this great speech about the Riddle of Steel, and really solid actor, really kind of grounds the film straight away. And the Riddle of Steel is this mystery that, you know, the gods lost it on the battlefield and men found it, you know, whatevs. And then we get the great opening where, you know, Thulsa Doom's men ride into the village, and there's this great double-headed serpent staff, and you see it. You know, the camera's back, and you see all of a sudden the staff coming up the hill because there's a horseman's riding on the other side of the hillside, and it's just rising up into the scene. It's really good. The costumes and the production design on the original film I like a lot. I mean, to me, it looks really good, very realistic. The garb of the Sumerians is mostly, you know, they're villagers, so it's mostly animal skins, and they look kind of like Eskimos in a way, and they live in the cold. So there's a realism to it that I like. You know, a lot of times in fantasy films, you know, you have villagers who look like they walked out of, you know, the central casting on the film 300, you know, but they're kind of all, you know, dressed in sheepskins and animal skins. And the design of Thulsa Doom's troops are really cool. They look good, very simple. The music is a little bombastic. I do love the music in this movie, but at times it can be very overdone. Not very bloody. You know, this attack, Conan's father is eventually killed by dogs. There's some blood. The village is torched. There's this very dramatic scene at the end of Conan and his mother. She's the only one left, and she's got this sword. Very beautiful actress. Rexor, we meet Rexor and Thorgrim, who are sort of Thulsa Doom's two big henchmen, these two huge guys. Rexor takes the sword that his father had just forged, and he gives it to Thulsa Doom. James Earl Jones takes off his helmet, and he's got this long hair, very unique-looking bad guy, I gotta say. He looks really cool in this film. He's got great armor. The helmet's really Baroque-looking, looks very realistic. And he goes into this thing that Thulsa Doom does where he hypnotizes his enemies, and he hypnotizes Conan's mother into lowering her blade. And then there's a very dramatic slow motion where Thulsa Doom turns away and then immediately flips back, and you see Conan's mother's head, as she has been decapitated, falling in front of the screen, although, of course, you don't see it close up. It's very dramatic. There's a, like, chorale music playing in the back. And what I like about this sequence is there's no talking. The mother is not saying a lot of things. The bad guys are not saying a lot of things. You know, when there's a lot of talking in some of these sequences, dialogue can always be cliche. You know, you'll never get me, Thulsa Doom. You know, drop the sword, man. You know, like, you can get all kinds of cliched movie dialogue. Milius chooses to go with silence. They all know what's going on. There's an implicit understanding that Thulsa Doom is there to annihilate the village. Later we find out he's looking for steel and looking for the riddle of steel at that point in his career. And that ends that. Okay, so then you have the same idea in the remake. And the remake immediately starts with a Lord of the Rings type of kind of redo. There's a quick voiceover narration from Morgan Freeman who describes a bit of the backstory to this world. And it's interesting is that this is taken from some of the things that Howard laid out. They talk about Acheron, and there's a Conan novel, I believe it's called Hour of the Dragon, where they resurrect an Acheronian sorcerer, and he defeats Conan in battle, and there's a whole thing about, you know, how Conan's going to defeat, I think it's Xaltaton, I think is the name of the sorcerer, but it is Acheron, and it was the old sort of Set-worshipping civilization. So they use that here, which I think is kind of cool. So the basic idea here, in the first film, no story is started. They just do a village massacre. And there is a bit of a story in that it's going to be more of a revenge pick. This one is going to be a revenge pick plus, you know, a quest. We get this idea that this mask, which is, you know, basically the ring, right, was constructed by these sorcerers, but then the barbarian tribes defeated them and broke the mask into several pieces, which were scattered across the land. Each tribe has a different piece of the mask, and there's a prophecy. So they go into all this crap, which the original doesn't go into any of it. The original is much more matter of fact about things. This is very Lord of the Rings. Someone would come along to put the mask together again and rule the world, blah, blah, blah. Very much like Rings, there's a lot of animatics. We're seeing battle sequences and fighting and so on and so forth. We've seen all this before, and it's like, okay, you know, we're in a bit of a retread, not terribly original. Very cool opening, though. We end that sequence with kind of looking at a child as if it's in the womb. It's all animated, and then some piece of metal comes into the womb, and the camera pulls out, and we realize that Conan's mother has been stabbed, which is very cool, very interesting and original scene right there. And the mother dies. The father actually has to cut the mother open to get Conan out, names the child Conan, and she's dead. Reminded me of the beginning of the Star Trek reboot, J.J. Abrams, where you have the, you know, Kirk's parents, basically, and the father giving his life and the mother giving birth to Conan. So kind of interesting. And we meet Ron Perlman, who plays Conan's father. So then we get this camera up on the village in Sumeria, and it's like the Shire. It's another Lord of the Rings crib, but there's a large water wheel there. Like, you know, just put a green door in the foreground and you have the Shire. So Perlman has a very similar speech talking about Crom and a warrior's ethos. And Perlman is not very good in this at all. He's a very flat delivery, very low key. I feel like, you know, these were like 2 days off of filming Sons of Anarchy. So he's just flat, boring. The actor who played the Conan's father in the originals, Far Superior, takes it far more seriously, and he's much more interesting, and Perlman's just boring. So there's this story that they are going to choose among the, you know, the youth of the tribe who's going to be able to go fight with the men. So they give them all these little eggs to put in their mouth, and the idea is they're going to run around the hill, nearby hill, and the first one to come back with the egg unbroken in their mouth gets to go to war with the men. So we start the sequence with just a bunch of young kids. As they push each other down, we see eggs breaking, and Conan's very aggressive, knocking everyone down. And then in the middle of it, they come across, I like to think they were Picts, Conan's enemies in the stories, especially Howard, with the Picts, which were an actual tribe back, I think, in Scotland. So the Picts are these, you know, semi-savage race that the Sumerians fought all the time. And they do a really good job, if they are Picts, in showing this group of warriors that's come to seemingly fight. As the kids are running around, they run into these warriors, and most of the kids bail. But Conan, seeing a chance for glory, remains on. And he's surrounded by about five or six of these warriors, and it's a really kind of cool battle. He is weaponless, and he defeats five of these Picts single-handed, and they show you very specifically how he kills each one. And it's very well directed, very well shot. It's clear how he kills each one. It's not super blizzard of cuts, which I despise. Some of the killing is really cool. What you also get here is they're not going to make the mistake of the first film, which, the first film in 1982, they didn't do much gore, They did some gory stuff. Again, there was beheadings. There were some kind of gory moments that were cool. But this film is really brutal, and we're going to get lots more blood. If you read the Howard stories, it's a bloody business, man. This is not Lord of the Rings. This is what you would call low fantasy, where Lord of the Rings is what's called high or epic fantasy. It's much more about other things. Where low fantasy, sword and sorcery fantasy that Howard sort of single-handedly invented, it's about killing and slashing and slaying and running away and, whatever. It's much more brutal. And so they're trying to do that here, which I like. I think it's good. So there's a very dramatic scene after they're in the village and all the kids are there, and Conan walks up with the heads of the five Picts in his hand, drops them in front of his father, spits out the egg, which is still intact. Like, he's so good, whatever. But it's, it's very dramatic. It's good movie making. After this, we do a little sword making. It's the same as the original film. They cast the sword blank first, which is whatever. And then they do a steal from Batman Begins, where his father's teaching him sword play out on the ice. We actually hear the phrase, mind your surroundings. And I was laughing, thinking, this is ridiculous, And then we have the invasion by the tribe. So the decimation of the village. And it has some good sweep to it. A lot of cool crane shots. It looks good. There's an initial Braveheart-style clash between horses. A lot of horse stunts here. There's one cool scene where they're dragging this huge flaming ball through the town and smashing and lighting houses on fire. There's a moment of archery that they steal right from Olivier's Henry V, where, you see the archer shoot the arrows up, and then the camera pans up in the air, and we see the arrows in flight and changing course to come down. Very neat, though. It's a good steal, I think. We meet Kalar Zim, who's the bad guy in this film, played by Stephen Lang. He's got this very cool double-bladed scimitar, which he will use later on to kind of cool effect. The initial massacre has been done. There's this tense scene now where Zim is confronting Conan's father, looking for the last fragment of the mask. And we see this mask that he has. There's one little chink at the bottom that's missing. He's almost got it complete. They're kind of beginning to torture his dad, and Conan's watching, and he jumps in, and he slices the nose off of one of Zim's guys. And the camera follows the nose as it drops on the floor and focuses in on it, which I think is great. It's it's brutal. We also meet Marik, Zim's daughter. I'm not sure who plays her as a young girl here, but she has these magical powers because she is a sorceress like Zim's wife, who I guess was a Asheronian sorcerer herself and was killed. And so he's trying to, part of him getting this mask together is to bring her back from the dead. And of course, rule, as all bad guys want to do. She kind of sniffs it out. She's got these Lady Deathstrike-like claws on her hands, which will be her character's main trait going forward. Finds the pissed bit of mask. It clicks into place. And we think in a moment, that's it. The bad guy's got the talisman kind of thing. And he says, we're halfway there. So then Zim mentions that there's some pure blood they have to find. And we don't know what that means yet in the film. He constructs this elaborate death scene where he chains Conan's father to this overhead bucket of molten steel and cuts his Achilles tendon. So as he's going to fall, he's going to pull the metal. He's going to pull the molten metal down on his head. Conan grabs a chain on the other side to hold it up, and Zim leaves them, very James Bondian death, like, I will leave you to have your son die in front of your eyes, and everybody leaves. And finally, his father convinces him to let go. And it's an actual gruesome scene when the molten steel comes down and impacts the father. You really see his head disintegrate. It's gross, man, but solid. You know, they're keeping it very brutal, as is Conan. You know, it's a very brutal character and living in a very brutal world. Of the two village sequences, to compare them now, a bit of a summary. Again, I think you can't beat modern movie making at a certain point. There was a definite stateliness and a realness to Milius's village scene, which I liked, but it still was very much like, you know, stuntmen on horseback and not a lot of blood. And Nispel, you're really getting the sense of those, you know, intervening years of cutting and CGI even, and the archers and, you know, the cool ball of fire. There's also some very interesting stuff. They thought through the village attack pretty well, and it's very interesting. It's one of the most interesting battles in the whole remake. So I think it kind of wins. It's kind of the better, the more interesting scene from my perspective. The original actor playing Conan's father is much better. There's way less dialogue in the original, which makes it kind of interesting. I think that James Earl Jones is much cooler than Kalar Zim, but I'll get to that when I do the comparisons of the two characters. I love that there's no talking. There's no bad guy cackling. And there's a lot of bad guy cackling and, you know, speaking out loud what his master plan is in this. And you're just like, okay. So now I'll compare the parts of both films that are after the village sequence, but before the real plot kicks in. I'll just call them. These are kind of the Conan's adventuring sequences of the film. So in the original film, Conan is captured and he's taken north with the Vanir tribesmen, or the tribesmen who were part of Thulsa Doom's crew. He's taken to this Wheel of Pain, which is a very cool set, very believable, very tactile. That's one thing the original, I think, has over the remake, in that it just looks more real, where the remake is in Lord of the Rings territory, where everything blends together to help with the CGI, but it also makes a lot of things look kind of, you know, just the way they look now in fantasy films, not terribly real, you know. So it's a great set. There's several match cuts of Conan walking around, basically this wheel grinding. I'm assuming it's grinding grain. And eventually, you know, the head pops up and it's Arnold's first shot in the film. The music swells, very dramatic. And there's a great detail of the ruts around the wheel. I thought it was a great detail, because if he's been walking this Wheel of Pain for maybe 10 years or so, 7, 10 years, there are ruts where the people walk and push this wheel, and it makes it even more, you know, realistic, I thought. So it was very cool. And Arnold's ridiculous here. His physique is out of control, and he's the only one left turning the wheel, and the Vanir guy, I guess, sells him to a gladiator school. Then immediately we're cut. They throw Conan into a gladiator ring. He's surrounded by people, and it's his first fight. You know, his opponent's got these sharpened teeth, and they draw blood from him right away. And I love the way he wins the first fight. He's very clumsy. He pins the guy's arm behind him and kind of batters it down, and then he bashes his head in. And, you know, he's just some kid who has no clue about how to fight. So he kills the most expedient way he can. And I think that, I don't know, it's very good. It's very solidly done in that way. And now you're getting basically a montage of a succession of fights that he's involved in. He's getting more elaborate armor. He's killing for sport. Obviously, he's being trained in all these ways. There's a continuing voiceover in the original film that I don't like. I think the guy who plays the sorcerer is doing a lot of voiceover telling you about what's going on the screen, and it's very unnecessary. You know, this is a very elemental film. It makes it kind of stupid, so I don't like that too much. They teach him how to handle all kinds of weapons. They give him a woman. You know, there's nudity here, which, again, I like. Both films are trying to stay in the R-rated, I'm sure, much to the consternation of the suits who bankrolled this whole thing. Arnold looks a little bit clumsy with a sword. He's so big. He's got some good moves, and he definitely practiced, but he just looks a little, I don't know, slightly clumsy, but I don't know. But he looks cool too. He has presence with that sword, and it looks right in his hand, so it's interesting. And here's where we get the classic first bit of Arnold's dialogue, where he's at a feast that his boss is throwing, and the boss asks him, Conan, what's best in life? Crush your enemies, see them driven before you, in this incredibly dense Austrian accent, which works in a film where, strangely enough, and I'll get to that when I talk about the two actors, that I think the accent really works here. You're in a strange land. You don't know anything about these people. Why should they sound like Americans, you know, or British, as it were? So, kind of cool. In a strange moment, Conan is summarily freed by his boss. We don't know why. His boss comes out drunk one day, drunk, cuts his chains, and sends him off. And I feel like it's a couple of times in this film that this happens. I feel like they missed the opportunity for a dramatic sequence here, that he should have figured out a way to escape or fought his way to freedom. Instead, we just have this moment where his boss is like, "Eh, you're free." You know, in a way that would, you know, this is an opportunity for us to see more of Conan's character, that he wouldn't just submit to being a slave, or he would want out. Does he like the life? Does he not like the life? But we don't get any of that, and there's not much character development in this film at all. So we get a brief adventure sequence from him. He's running from these wolves, and he finds this burial cairn and goes and falls inside of it, and he sees this king sitting on a throne with this wonderful old sword. The buried king is really cool looking here, very realistic. Again, the original just, you know, when you're at close-ups and you're in the scenes, the original just looks so much better. The sets are better. They don't look like the Lord of the Rings cast-offs, you know? It's not New Zealand, you know what I mean? So it's a bit scary. The lighting is great. You don't know if this thing's going to come to life. Here's the thing. The movie wants you, Conan says, Crom. So the movie wants you to believe that he found Crom, his god, and this is Crom's sword, whatever. It doesn't make any sense. It's dumb. It's the writers not understanding who Conan is. There was, I believe, a story that Sprague de Camp wrote that this scene is based off of, and I think. And it's basically, it should be an old Atlantean king, and it's old steel, not Crom. Yeah, I think that's all it is. And in the story, Conan has this thing comes to life, and Conan has to fight it to get the sword or to get out alive. It cuts off his escape. And again, there's another chance for drama here. You know, Conan has to fight for this weapon, but he doesn't. He just gets the weapon, and he goes back out, and it's shot in a way where you realize he's going to kill the wolves, and now he has his defense. So again, it's flat. It's very flat, and there's no chance for Conan. He's not in any danger again. Now we finally have a little dramatic moment, and there's a reason for this scene. He comes across this woman who invites him into her hut. So basically, we're getting a little of the beginning of the story. He's on a kind of a revenge quest. He's looking for that battle standard of Thulsa Dooms, which is the two snakes that are one snake. And so they're having sex, and the woman tells him, you know, in Zamora is where you'll find your answers. And as they're having sex, she turns into some crazy, like, vampire and starts biting him, and he tosses her into the fire, and she becomes basically this light. And then shoots out of the fire and out of the hut, and she's gone. There was a reason for the scene to exist. He knows Zamora is where he has to go. Then he acquires his ally, his first ally, Subutai, who's a thief and, you know, identifies himself as thief and archer. He's Hycranian, which I think is sort of Howard's analog for the steppe people, you know, Mongolian and possibly Chinese steppe people. He's chained up along the side of a road. Arnie sets him free. And then they have this really fun dialogue where they compare gods, and I thought, I really like this because it's kind of like what would two people talk about who didn't know each other, like, who do you pray to? I pray to Crom, you know. And there's this funny sequence where Subutai plays to the four winds. You know, Conan's like, Crom laughs at your four winds. So there's like it makes sense that they would argue, like, my god's better than your god, and Subutai wins the argument because he says, well, Crom's below my god, my god's in the sky. And I just thought that was clever. That's how two people might talk back in the day who had nothing else to talk about. Like, well, what gods do you worship? So it's kind of sharp. He enters Zamora, this great walled city of Zamora, city of thieves. We see that there is a snake cult of Set in the city. He gets drunk and punches a camel. There's that famous scene. But he's really a goofball here. He's really a lunkhead and kind of stupid. And this is the Conan that I don't really love. They're given some drugs, some black lotus leaves to chew, which, if you're in Howard's story, the black lotus is like opium. So here it seems to be a stimulant. They chew some, and then they sneak into this Tower of Set, and they meet on the way Valeria, who's another thief, and they're wanting to steal the Eye of the Serpent, which is in this tower. And Valeria is played by Sandhal Bergman. She's fantastic. I think she's the best thing in the movie. She looks great. She moves great. She's just very likable. They team up together. They climb up the tower, and then they climb a rope down the shaft into this setting where Rexor is there, and they're all praying, and there's this giant snake. The giant snake battle is cool because, again, pre-CGI, they had to actually make this damn thing. So it looks very real. They can film from back a ways when Arnold's wrestling with it. They don't have to do a thousand cuts in CGI. So it really looks like it's there. There's a lot of blood when he cuts into it. You know, he basically kills it by sorting it up through the jaws. It's very cool. Rexxar sees him, but they all kind of, you know, they all climb up and they get away. It's kind of boring at the end of the day. The only cool thing is really the snake sequence. But Milius takes his time. I like that he does take his time, but it can be boring as well. And it's not the greatest sequence, you know, especially in a modern movie sense, to go back. And you're either going to do something stately and dramatically interesting, but if you're just going to do an action scene that's you know, cut and edited very slowly, it's kind of boring, you know. We get a little bit of Conan's character. Him and Valeria have sex, and he gives her the main Eye of the Serpent, which he stole, which the serpent was twirling around. A very cool set. The snake set was very cool, actually. Again, looked very real. And he gives her the biggest jewel of the whole pot, and she puts it around her neck, so and we'll see that later. So now let's cut to the remake. Same section. After the village is destroyed, there is no... Conan is not captured. There's no Wheel of Pain sequence. We just catch up to Conan now as an adult, played by Jason Momoa, who's becoming like the guy, the go-to guy for fantasy characters. He played Khal Drogo in Game of Thrones. He's going to be Aquaman in the Justice League. So he's part of some mercenary band. I think he's a pirate, actually. They have this ship. There's a character named Artis, played by an actor named Nonso Anozi. It's a Zingaran slave colony, and Conan wants to kind of free the slaves. And what I like about the remake is they keep to the geography of the Hyborian world. You know, Zingara is a real country. It's a real country in Howard's map. If you go online and you look at the Hyborian world, you'll see maps. And Howard was very, very detailed. I mean, it kind of looks like a mini version of Europe, but, you know, Zingara, I believe... Zingara and Argos are like Spain and Portugal, kind of. Aquilonia is France, and, you know, Shem, I think, is Israel and or Palestine. So it's kind of fun to go back and look at the names of these places, and you can kind of go one-to-one. Kush is, and there wasn't, I believe, an ancient Kush in Africa. So kind of cool. And they're keeping that in the remake, which I like. Pretty cool stunts. They're up on a hillside, and they throw down these huge rocks, which then smash the slavers apart. And the sword fighting is very bloody now. They're cutting off limbs. There's lots of blood. Very good. A lot of quick cuts, but, you know, Momoa looks great with a sword, and the sword fights are not long, which, the more I'm studying sword fighting, duels are very short between two combatants. Like, you're in one, two, it's done. You know, someone's getting hit, someone's dying. It's not like the 9-hour Princess Bride sword fight battles. Like, those don't exist in real life. So they're keeping to that, in that any sword duel in this universe, same in the original, too. They do that very well. Like, it's very realistic looking. You know, you don't have these large battles. They're a little longer, actually, in the original. They do some, like, sword-hitting sword stuff. But here, basically, Conan is just cutting a swath through people. And it looks great. So they free all these slaves, and they take this pirate ship to Mesantia, which is actually in nearby Argos. It's also on Howard's map, which I think is really neat. Conan and Artis are in a pub, you know, getting wasted. And Artis talks about what an amazing guy Conan is. He's like, when Conan was a young man, he stole he climbed the Tower of the Elephant and stole the jewel of the sorcerer Yara. And that's a real story, the Tower of the Elephant, which it's the second story that was published about Conan. So again, whoever's writing, if it's this Sean Hood guy, I mean, he really did his homework, and he's really trying to connect it to Howard's world, which I like. I like that. But so here's where the plot starts to begin, and he sees the guy who he cut the nose off of when he was a kid, who now has this elaborate leather face thing on, but he recognizes the guy. So a young thief, a guy named El Ashan, comes in hiding from guards and from this guy, and Conan sees that, and he goes up to the thief, and he's like, let's get captured. I want to go to where this guy is. And so he gets captured on purpose. And then he wants to find, you know, the guy with the no nose. And so he basically kills most of the guards that are guarding him, while this guy is torturing the El Ashan character. And it's a really bloody scene where the torture room can only be opened from the inside, and the camera's inside pointing out, and the little door opens, and it's the captain of the guard. And as the door opens, it's the captain's head, and Conan's holding it. He's beheaded the guy. So wonderfully gruesome. Very gory. He comes in. He kills two or three guards. He pulls off the guy's face mask, and we see the hole in his head where his nose used to be, and Conan puts his finger in it. And then we cut to the ground, and the guy's peeing. It's just gross. They're, you know, and they're keeping it very visceral, which I think is great. And they end this where Conan sticks the keys to all of the slaves' bonds, makes the guy swallow it, and then tells all the slaves that, you know, the key to your freedom's in this guy's belly, and gives them a knife. So really kind of gross, but the purpose of this whole scene is that he finds out about this guy, Kolar Zim, who he knows about, but he doesn't realize that he was the same guy who came to his village. So now we have the object of his quest in hand, so he knows what he's going to do. So now let me just do briefly the main stories of the two films as they go, and I'll start with the original. So the main thrust of, again, there's two stories in both films. Conan wants revenge against Thulsa Doom, but also he, Valeria, and Subutai are captured by King Osric, who's discovered that they've looted this temple. And he salutes them for it because he hates the snake cults are popping up in all the cities of the Hyborian nations, and no one knows really what to do. They're getting very popular. So Osric's daughter has been taken, or she's joined one of these cults, and he wants her back. So the plot basically is, go get my daughter, which coincides nicely with Conan's revenge scheme, right? So you've got that. Some points to mention about the story. The mountainside set of Thulsa Dooms is really terrific. The one thing about the original is that they really are sets built in the middle of nowhere. Like, the Wheel of Pain is, like, out in the middle of a desert. There's nothing else near it. Thulsa Doom's hideout, it's this thing just built on the side of a mountain. There's nothing else for miles around. So, you know, take about it what you will. They look great, very realistic and well-built sets, and very well shot. Just as long steps leading up to a temple. Great costume, great armor on the guards. I do like a moment when they're captured and Thulsa Doom is talking to Conan about the Riddle of Steel. And he's saying that the Riddle of Steel is that flesh is stronger. One of his acolytes is standing up on a ledge and Thulsa Doom is like, come here, my child. And she just jumps to her death. You know, the Riddle of Steel, he's found it. The flesh is stronger. Steel is nothing but the hand that'll wield it, so on and so forth. So that's kind of cool. And there's no real theme in the remake in any way. So there is a, you know, at least an attempt at some kind of thematic thing here in the original. So then we have the Tree of Woe, which is really great. And again, it's in the middle of nowhere, right? It's a bit of a set. But there's a great scene of Arnold, you know, where a vulture's starting to peck at one of his wounds and he bites it in the neck and kills it, which is great. And then the camera shoots from up at Arnold's feet. It's a very epic sort of godlike shot I really like. There's a brief rescue. You know, Subutai and Valeria were not captured. Conan was, because he tried to sneak in to the palace on his own. The wizard, they find this wizard, Mako. This guy's name is Mako, playing the wizard. I'm sure the actor's name is Mako. And there's this elaborate scene where they have to kind of bring Arnold back to life, and they write symbols all over his body. At night, what the wizard tells his friends is, like, you have to hold on and hold to protect him, because the spirits are going to try to take him away, and if they fail, you know, he'll come back to life. And very dated, very poltergeisty kind of effects here when the spirits come out. And you get the beginning of Valeria's promise when he wakes up, like, you know, I'll give my life for you, and if I do die, death won't stop me from coming back and protecting you if you need it. So, very cool. Love Valeria. The war paint they wear is really great in the original. I love when they get all painted up to go sneak into the place. Very cool. There's a long orgy sequence where we realize that, you know, the people in the snake cult are being fed the remains of human beings, so they're eating, like, flesh soup. It's pretty gross. Woman sort of grabs an arm and starts nibbling on it. So very creepy. We get Thulsa Doom's transformation from human into snake, which is brief. It's basically, you know, you could tell it's an animatronic face being pushed out, and then you cut quickly to the fact that it's a huge snake there. So his reveal. I like it still. There's a very, very long, boring setup for the fighting. I mean, we watch them sneak around this compound for, like, it seems like forever, with the music crescendoing. But, you know, once it gets to the fighting, it's pretty cool. Valeria cuts the head off a guard. It was very gory. Could definitely use more. The sword strikes are very well choreographed, and they're mostly shot without cuts, so there's definitely good choreography here. You have Rexxar and Thorgrim now arrive. We hear the main Basil Palidorus theme kick in. Very rousing. Conan's fighting Rexxar and Thorgrim, and then they're separated by this column that Thorgrim's hammer has destroyed. Valeria has a great move here where, as they're all trying to escape with Osric's daughter, she's about to face off with two guards, and she does a run up the side of the cave wall and jumps around and kills them. Very cool. You know, it wasn't shot the greatest, but it's a cool move. Then we have what I think is amazing in this film that, although they I think they were planning on bringing her back to life at some point, Thulsa Doom kills Valeria with his serpent arrow. He kind of takes this serpent out of his body and straightens it out, and he hits her as they're riding away. Very adult, I thought. As gory as the remake is, like, you know, it's never anything serious at all. But we really like Valeria, and the fact that she's dead at this point in the story, I thought was like, holy shit, you know. And they didn't bring her back to life. I mean, she comes back briefly for one moment, but it's not that she's alive again. So I thought it was a tough little moment, you know, that they kill her off. So now they have Osric's daughter. They put her up on a, you know, they sort of tie her to some rock, and they're waiting for Thulsa Doom's people to come and get her back. So we have this Battle of the Cairn. There's a lot of battle preparations, which made me think of the film Predator to Come, which was John McTiernan and different. But the battle preparations, you know, they're making all these traps for the horsemen. You have this funny prayer to Crom that Conan is like, Crom, grant me revenge, and if you do not listen, to hell with you. You know, classic Arnold. So we get the battle. The horsemen are very real. It's shot really well. I mean, everything looks very realistic. Conan starts this battle out with his massive axe, and now they pile on the blood, which is good. Lots of horse stunts. A lot of guys tumbling from horseback as they take guys out. There's definitely a sense of place. It's not the best choreographed fight. When we get to near the end, we have Conan versus Thorgrim and Rexxor, which is the big battle scene. He disembowels Rexxor's horse, puts him out for a time, and then it's him and Thorgrim, who's got this big hammer, and he hides and puts his helmet on top of like a trigger, so Thorgrim smashes it down, and this incredible trap is sprung where this huge limb is then goes right through Thorgrim's chest, and he is killed. It's a good moment. It's a good moment. Then Rexxor wakes up, and so him and Conan are fighting, and he's even bigger than Schwarzenegger, which is just amazing. I think he was a football player, this guy. Looks really good. And at one point, he has Conan pretty much to rights. He knocks him down, his sword's out. But his sword strike is intercepted by Valeria, who steps in from the grave and, you know, do you want to live forever? Which is her wonderful line in this film. So then they're sword to sword, and, you know, Conan gives him a nice good belly cut, shatters the sword that he's holding, which was his dad's sword. Lots of blood, really good. And then Thulsa Doom is the only one left, and he attempts to kill Osric's daughter rather than lose her, and shoots another sort of snake arrow at her, but Subutai's there, blocks it, and he bails. Then we have the finale, which is very Apocalypse Now, right? Emilius wrote most of Apocalypse Now. It's a beautiful scene at night on the stairs. Doom's at the top of the steps, and his only torches below. You know, he basically, Arnie sneaks back in yet again with Osric's daughter, who basically at this point realizes that she was kind of being had. There's a final face-off between the two, and he tries the hypno trick. They try to do this Darth Vader thing where he's like, I'm your father. Who but me? You know, I'm the purpose of your whole life. When I'm gone, you'll be empty. There'll be an emptiness inside you'll never reclaim. So kind of clever. But I assume because Arnold's wearing the Eye of the Serpent still that he took off of Valeria after she died, that is a magical talisman and protects him from Doom's hypnotist magic. So basically decapitates him, holds his head up to the crowd, and then throws it down on the steps, drops his sword, which is sort of the cue for everyone there to drop their torches, and the cult is now disbanded. And it's, oh my God, it's basically shot for shot, just like the end of Apocalypse Now, when Willard drops his sword, and so does everyone else in the cult. So the story of the 2011 film, very similar. There's two stories. Conan wants revenge of the guy who killed his father. And coincidentally, he's not really trying to stop Zim from, you know, taking over the world. It's kind of, it's weird. We know that Zim's doing this other thing where he's going to bring back all this sorcery. But Conan never really gives a shit about it. Neither does anyone else in the film. So it's kind of strange. So we have this pure blood, our heroine, played by Rachel Nichols, who is the green alien in Abrams' Star Trek, briefly. So Shapur is the place where our heroine lives, and she's the last of a pure blood of Acheron. And she, you know, is basically being protected by these monks, and Zim finally finds out where she lives, and he assaults this Shapur city. Very Lord of the Rings. There's a large land ship that Zim kind of goes around in. And it's basically a gate-smashing device pulled by elephants. Very solid. Really looks cool, but very Lord of the Rings playbook, if you will. We're now, you know, getting the adult Marik, who's Zim's daughter, played with annoying cackling glee by Rose McGowan. She's just annoying and very cliched as the, you know, kind of the sick, twisted daughter of the bad guy. Brief plot going on. You know, Tamara, who's the pure blood heroine, They get her out of the city via carriage. Conan isn't anywhere near yet, but he's on the way to this city. He sees this carriage with a symbol on it of Zim's, which is the mask, basically. He thinks Zim is in it. He jumps on top. It's actually her. And then other folks from Shapur battle with the troops, and basically everyone dies, and Conan and her, and this guy Remo, who's the only one left. And Remo was there in the beginning in the village in Conan's father's tent. Very cool-looking character. It reminded me of very orc-like. They definitely did a little orc job on him. So, again, although he's cool-looking, you know, it's Lord of the Rings playbook. We get the plot bit that Zim wants Tamara because she's the last pure blood of Acheronian line. She doesn't even know it, but she's needed for this rite of sorcery that he wants. He basically overpowers Remo, and they go back to Shapur, and he sees this big landship where Zim is sort of hiding out in. And he puts Remo in a trebuchet and a piece of Tamara's clothing in his mouth and flings him. There's a great scene where Zim's in his, like, you know, anteroom, and Remo comes smashing in, and they realize that Conan wrote a little note, you know, come alone to this location. I have the girl, and so on and so forth. So there's the initial meet in this abandoned little city, or little town, I should say. Zim, of course, doesn't come alone. He brings his daughter with him. There's an initial fight between these sandmen monsters. So she, you know, she's a sorceress, and she creates these monsters who come out of the sand. And, you know, when Conan cuts one down, another one springs up right behind them. So it's kind of cool. Very CGI fight, but it's not bad. And it's kind of a clever, you know, conceit. The sandmen warriors. Kind of Jason and the Argonauts, right? Sowing the seeds and fighting the skeletons a little bit. But it's not bad. And then he duels Zim. He kills all of the Sandmen, and now he's about to fight Zim. And Zim's got this dual-bladed scimitar, which at one point the blades kind of unclasp, and it's almost like he's got like a double-bladed lightsaber at a time. It's a cool weapon where it's two scimitars parallel to each other, and then one can flip out, and so you can kind of have a double-bladed sword staff in some way, which he uses, and it's kind of cool looking. But Conan's pretty irresistible at this point, except now the daughter spoils the fight. She hits him with a little flying blade that has this, you know, poison in it, so he starts to lose it. And Zim now beats him, and he's taunting him. But he and Tamara get away, and they do a classic adventure movie jump into the water, where Artur and the ship are all waiting, and so they escape. So then we have a pirate ship battle, which I bet, you know, the executives were like, it's Pirates of the Caribbean, we gotta have a pirate ship fight. And the fight makes no sense. It's basically Zim's men attack the ship to try to get Tamara, and they're beaten, and nothing happens, and there's no consequences. So if you like pirate scenes, go to town. I mean, you know what's coming. You know at some point Tamara's going to get kidnapped, because that's how the end of the movie is going to be. You just know it. Conan basically leaves. He's going after Zim alone. Tamara comes to him one night, and they have sex. And in the morning when she's walking back to the ship, she's taken and captured. And, like, what a shock. Almost similar to the first film as well, where they have to go capture someone and who's been kidnapped, right? So, of course, this is where Conan goes to find the thief, whom he met earlier, who will sneak him now into Zim's lair. There's this fight with this octopus monster in the beginning, which made me think of Lord of the Rings. The Watcher in the Waters Before the Walls. It's okay. Very CGI. It is what it is. They get in, but they're too late, and Zim's able to fill the mask with blood from Tamara, and the mask basically turns into like an alien face hugger. It comes alive. It's like a face hugger with a hole in the middle of it. Puts it on, and now he's much more powerful, although, you know, he doesn't do much with it right away. Then there's the final battle. You've got the daughter and Tamara who escapes, and you've got Zim and Conan, and there's all kinds of yelling and cackling and fighting and, you know, Spielbergian daring do. And I don't know, at that point in the movie, you know, like scraping the bottom of your popcorn bucket, because it's very well mounted. You know, like often with these kind of films, they're very well mounted, very well done. I would never want to take away from all of the work that all these incredible artists and creative people put into making these things come to life. But when you haven't built a compelling story about compelling characters, and there's no real reason for this to exist, Conan's, he's just a revenge guy. No one gives a shit. No one cares about Tamara. The end fight is very, very, you know, transformery, as it were. So to compare the two, I mean, both plots, frankly, are kind of dull. There's not much to them. They're both revenge plots. There's much more pure action in the remake. There's actually story points in the remake where you know, Conan has to fight more and more to get out of things, whereas in the original, there's a lot more dullness, and they get, you know, they, when they leave Osric and they walk all the way to Thulsa Doom's hideout, nothing happens. They just get there, you know, there's no, they don't have to go find someone first and then do something else. So it's kind of underwritten in that way. In the remake, the story just moves along better. Ultimately, both of these movies are popcorn movies, right? They're not very deep films, and the remake is just, you know, there's more going on. So you're like, okay, it's very samey and dull, like a lot of, you know, non-Lord of the Rings, but Lord of the Rings-looking fantasy films are like. And parts of the original can be very boring. I mean, there's a lot of scenes in the original near the end where they're building up to climactic battles where there's just a lot of Basil Polydorus' music and a lot of sneaking around. It's just, oh man, it's a Snoresville. Even the penultimate scene with Thulsa Doom, like, you're forever up on that hillside looking at those torches, you know? Like, it's dull. It's kind of dull. So I do like that the remake does go for more bloody stuff. Like, there's some, you know, the nose and the father's head being disintegrated, and there's a lot more gore and killing. It's a little more brutal. I do like the original. It was also similar in that way as well. They're both going for adult audiences. In the original, I really like the pit fighter sequence and Arnold being bred to a woman. Like, none of this is made triumphant in any way, or like, you know, he's just, this is what he does. He's like a very, it's like a very professional world that he becomes part of, and it's not, you know, epic fantasy-ish in any way. I do like where the original trucks in a lot more silence than the remake does. Thulsa Doom has given some wonderful lines in the original film, but not a lot of them. So he's, to me, he has more menace. Kalar Zim is just your basic cackling bad guy. He wants to rule the world. He's very boring. No one really cares much about him. It's just a lot more silence and space in the original film. And sometimes when you're looking at some of the sets, it matters. Like, I like the sets in the original much better. They just look more real. When the actors are in the sets and you've got Milius really shooting it wide, they look great. The stuff in the remake is just Lord of the Rings light. It all looks similar. You've seen it everywhere before. It's shot in such a way where you're really never given a chance to kind of just sit and look at the place. And everything is very disposable. So all right. So let's talk about the cast. Let's compare the cast a little bit. The problem to me with both Conans is that, like I said earlier, you know, Conan to me is a very smart, cunning warrior. He's, you know, even as a young fighter, like, he's a very sharp dude. You know, and a barbarian is just a weird title that people... I think that 82 film really, really screwed with the public's perception of what Conan is. And I think even to this day, I don't think any Conan film that will be made will be able to pull away the tone that Milius set in 82, which is a shame. Because I think if you did like a Conan on Netflix, the way they're doing Daredevil, like, you can get down to the really nitty-gritty of Conan character. Of course, you don't have the money to do the effects, but you'd get better character stuff. Although, truth be told, Conan is not a deep character. He's an interesting, cool character in that he knows a lot of shit. He knows how to do a lot of stuff. He's very cunning and clever. And he has a rude code of honor in the stories, too, that, you know, civilized nations, when he comes in contact with people who are robbing and stealing and cheating each other, he kind of walks through them with this rude code of honor that he won't break. And it's a great kind of contrast at times. Both of the film versions, you know, obviously the first one, he's just kind of an idiot. You know, he has a good heart where he gives Valeria the stone. You know, he's like definitely a good guy, but he's a dope, you know. And Arnold's face and the accent comes across as like he's kind of a lunkhead. And Momoa's a little better. You know, Momoa speaks better. Momoa looks more intelligent. There's something coming out of his eyes that's just more intelligent than what's coming out of Arnie's eyes in the original. But he's kind of one-notey in that it's like he's gruff and all about revenge, and there's not much to him either, you know. But he's at least a little bit better, and he's a little bit smarter in terms of you see him, you know, using tactics to defeat people and so on and so forth. But both of them, I think, film versions of, really neither has gotten to the essence of what I think is that character. So the actors playing the father, again, I really like the original actor versus Perlman, who's very flat. Valeria versus Tamara, I mean, Sandhal Bergman is the best. I think Valeria is by far a more interesting character. Tamara's just another hot Hollywood girl. And, you know, Valeria's a fucking warrior, man. She's her own deal. And Tamara's just another girl that has to be saved and rescued, which I think they missed the boat on that one. So I think Valeria wins on that one. As far as the bad guys go, in the original film, Rexxar and Thorgrim are kind of just these hulking dudes. And then in the remake, you have, you know, the guy who looks like an orc who's kind of cool looking, the guy with the nose who's just a dude, and then there's this other character who's like really super strong, who Conan kills at some point. I don't know. You could go either way on this. Rexxar and Thorgrim are kind of just really imposing, monstrous guys, where the guys in the remake are just kind of like, I don't know. Neither movie really has the interesting henchmen. And then you have Kalar Zim versus Thulsa Doom, and I feel like Thulsa Doom is the better bad guy. First of all, when James Earl Jones is doing, you know, big speeches, his voice is unbelievable. And the monologues are more interesting when he's talking about the Riddle of Steel and when he's talking about how your whole purpose of your life is me. Like, there are interesting thematic elements, and Doom becomes a really smart, and his whole plan is to train these cultists to go back into civilization and sort of take down the world from underneath. You know, he doesn't have any big magic. It's just a basic, you know, he's a very charismatic cult snake guy. But these people are going to take the world down from below, which is, I think, is a more creepy and interesting story than Kalar Zim's, you know, I got to get the magic thing so I can rule the world crap. Even though Stephen Lang is terrific. I think he's a really good actor. So he does what he can with an extremely limited character. So he's very good. He's got a great voice as well, a really good presence, but there's not much to work with here. So supporting characters, Subutai is sort of disposable. Mako in the original is very kooky but memorable. In the remake, Artist is boring but kind of likable. That actor is very likable. That the guy who plays the thief is very unmemorable. Basically, to summarize, I don't think it's a clear-cut case here of one film being so much better than another. I think there are certain elements in the original that are good and that are better. There are certain elements in the remake that are better. I think it's catch-as-catch-can here. I'll default to the original. I think I won't. I'll probably watch the original more in the future because I really like the sets. I like the stately pace of it at times. I like Basil Poledouris's music. Things just look a little more real in the 82 movie. They look a little more substantial and less fake. Whereas in the remake, lots of it look CGI. And, you know, when you get into that everything CGI look, after a while, it's just, I don't know. I don't like it. It kind of bores me. So just a little bit of trivia. I'll do just trivia about the 1982 film. The idea of painting symbols onto Conan's body to help ward off spirits was taken from a Japanese story called Hoichi the Earless. So that was a real thing, I guess, that Milius had read about and did. James Earl Jones was a last-minute addition to the cast because of his commitments on Broadway. He and Schwarzenegger became friends on set. Schwarzenegger helped Jones stay in shape, and Jones coached Schwarzenegger on acting, as Max von Sydow did. Schwarzenegger was very, very humble earlier in his career. He really, you know, knew that he had so much to learn. And so when he went on films, he really kind of played the apprentice to all the bigger or better actors in his movies, which I think is credit for him. Conan's response, that line he has about crush your enemies, is an abbreviation of a real quote attributed to Genghis Khan, which is, quote, the greatest pleasure is to vanquish your enemies and chase them before you, rob them of their wealth and see those dear to them bathed in tears, to ride their horses and clasp to your bosom their wives and daughters. Ouch, end quote. Subutai was actually the name of one of Khan's generals, so there's a connection there. Also, despite the film being named for Conan, the character's personal history seems to be based more on Howard's character, Kull the Conqueror. Howard gives no detailed origins to Conan, but he does give one to Kull. Kull was exiled from his homeland, spent time as a slave and then a gladiator before usurping a throne. And Thulsa Doom is an enemy of Kull's and not Conan's, so kind of interesting. That's my original versus remake take on Conan the Barbarian.
Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website www.scifionscreen.com. And you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen. And that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page. And on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.